White Rocket Entertainment.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the second pod is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week we feature an interview with author and filmmaker Bruce Sively. Bruce is the author of comprehensive and amazing books on James Bond, Superman, Batman, and Dracula, as well as working in Hollywood on projects such as the James Bond DVD special features. I met Bruce for the first time at the Superman Celebration event in Metropolis, Illinois a couple of weekends ago, and instantly realized he would be a perfect guest for the show, so we sat down to discuss Bond and all those other topics. As a side note, Bruce grew up in North Alabama, and he went off to Hollywood to get involved in the movie business about the same time I went off from Alabama to Washington, D.C. to get involved in the politics business. And now we both live in Illinois. How remarkable. Small world, huh? So, without further ado, here's Bruce chatting with me about James Bond and more. Enjoy! Okay, I'm here with Bruce Sively, and he is a fascinating guy that I've encountered this weekend. I'm at the Superman Celebration in Metropolis, Illinois, and had no idea he was going to be here. And over the next hour or so, he and I are going to chat about all kind of interesting things, including James Bond and a few of the other topics that he's written books about and is interested in. He's got a fascinating story behind it all. And so let me go ahead and bring you on board, Bruce. Thanks for being on the White Rocket Show this week, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Now, first off, tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you do, and how you've come to be involved in things like James Bond, Superman, and so forth.
Well, it's a long and winding story. I'll try to give you the Cliff Notes version. I grew up in North Alabama, back in the backside of nowhere, really. But always loved movies since I was a little kid, and about 12 years old, I guess, when Goldfinger came on TV for the first time. Mm-hmm. And once I saw that, I got hooked on James Bond. Before that, I was really into like Universal Monsters and used to watch The Saint and The Avengers and things like that on TV. And loved movies, wanted to get into the film business. So when I got out of high school, I applied to USC, University of Southern California, went out there, stayed in Los Angeles for the next 26 years, worked for several different film companies, and ended up producing special features for DVDs. And one of the ones I did was the special features for the James Bond films, which was, you know, the 12-year-old inside me was just jumping for joy when we got that gig.
That alone would make you a coveted special guest for our show because, as I might have mentioned to you already, my semi-regular co-host John Ringer and I, as our listeners know, we've done quite a few episodes lately about the James Bond movie series, and so I really want to talk to you about stuff like the extras on the DVDs and the stuff you got to work with there and the book that you did based on the James Bond stuff. But you've also worked on some other properties too. Tell us a little bit about the other things that you've been involved in.
Well, after doing the James Bond DVDs, John Cork had started his own company, Cloverland, and John and I had known each other. I met him when I was at USC, and the thing that brought us together is we were both James Bond fans, and we were, oddly enough, both from Alabama. So we used to always joke the best Bond fans come from Alabama.
There's three of us then.
There we go.
It's amazing.
It keeps getting smaller and smaller.
We got a little club. It's amazing.
There we are, the Bama Bond Club.
Mm-hmm. So.
But anyway, John and I, we kept doing the DVD special editions, did the special editions for everything from Legally Blonde to The Great Escape, Charlie Chan film series, Mr. Moto, Fish Called Wanda, Bridge Too Far, quite a bit of stuff. So I really enjoyed doing that work. And after doing it for a while, I got married to someone who lived in Chicago. So I ended up eventually moving to Chicago and kind of got out of the out of L.A., out of the film business for a while, and started teaching for the next 6 or 7 years. And now I'm the vice president of a company called New Dimension Media that provides educational videos to classrooms, K-12 classrooms all over the country. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the other projects I've been involved with, besides the James Bond book, when we finished that, I wanted to do something else that would take me back to my childhood, kind of. So I did a book on Superman in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Went off to promote that at cons and so on, and everyone would say, when are you going to do one on Batman? So I wrote a book about Batman in movies and TV. And then after that, did a little ebook on the Matt Helm movies from the 60s, which I thought...
Not a lot of competition there, I'm thinking, right?
You know, I thought me and maybe three other people are going to be interested in Matt Helm, but I sell 2 or 3 copies of that every month.
And wow.
It's been out for a couple of years now, so there's a few more Matt Helm fans out there than you'd think.
How about that?
The most recent book I have is Dracula FAQ, which again takes me back to my childhood, because one of the first movies I remember seeing on television was Bela Lugosi's Dracula. So,
mm-hmm.
And I'm here promoting Dracula this weekend.
That's one of the things I thought was fascinating for the audience out there, when Bruce and I first started talking today, just so you guys listening can understand just how amazingly kind of freakishly cosmic this all was. This is a guy I'm talking to right now that's from rural Alabama, went off to college in another state because he was interested in something he wasn't going to do in Alabama, big James Bond fan, and has done nonfiction books about these kind of properties. Sound kind of familiar, doesn't it, to my listeners? Right, they know. So yeah, we kind of have a rapport about, in this way. And so...
Must be something in the cornbread.
Cornbread, that's right. We just had some cornbread. We had dinner a while ago. So, okay, so we got the background kind of the way. So... You started out doing the DVD extras, right, for the James Bond series, which I believe are the ones I own.
Actually, the first ones I did were around 1995. John Cork and some other guys, Lee Pfeiffer, Mark Cerulli, Dave Worrell, I forget who the other guys were hired to do laser discs of Goldfinger and Thunderball. And John asked me if I wanted to come and help on that, so I did. And really enjoyed working on those. And a few years after the Laserdisc came out, actually about 4 years later, 1999, I was working at a temp job, of all things, in L.A. between other paying gigs, and got a call from John one day saying, MGM's decided they want to go ahead and do DVDs of all the James Bond films, just like the Laserdisc we'd done a few years back. Would you like to work on those? And I said, absolutely. So he said, well, what would it take to get you away from your job? And I quoted him a figure, and he said, done. And off we went, and I spent the next year and a half basically doing nothing but eat, breathing, and sleeping James Bond. Because John and I, we knew this was a big opportunity, and we were both big Bond fans. So we were working literally 7 days a week, like 16, 18, 20 hours a day some days, to... tried to make the best DVDs we could out of those, and I think we did a pretty good job. There's still some things when I look at them now that I see and think, oh, I wish we'd had a little more time to work on this or change that. But when you're doing those kinds of projects, all you can do is just do the best job you can do given the time constraints and the budget that you have.
I don't think people realize how much time and work must go into stuff like that, right?
It's quite a lot. I mean, first you have to do all the research, and then come up with the scripts for the things, go out and do the interviews, you got to get them edited, you got to do the sound mixing, then deliver the masters to the studio and hope everything goes well there. So yeah, it's quite a lot of work, but I really enjoyed doing it.
Did you have a connection with the famous audio commentaries on those early Laserdiscs that...
I did not. Those were done by another producer, Stephen J. Rubin, who's a good friend of mine, actually, Stephen. I think when they did those with, was it Terrence Young was one of them? And, you know, some of these guys, like Terrence Young, I mean, they were great raconteurs. And a lot of the British actors I've met are like this, too. You know, you get them talking and they'll just go on for hours and tell these wonderful stories, about 30 or 40% of which may actually be factually true. You know, and I think that was the thing with Terrence Young. It's like he had this font of wonderful stories, but you couldn't absolutely verify all of it. And some of the things he was saying, I think, were considered maybe not quite too politically correct.
Right. So they ended up not using them, right?
So they ended up not using them. And when we were doing our DVDs, there were a few things that, we would turn into MGM, and either MGM or their attorneys would come back to us, or Standards Division or whatever, and say, we'd rather you not say this, or could you please take this out, and so on. And we always complied with that, because as John Cork kept reminding me, we're not the dog, we're just the fleas on the dog's back.
So. But you can get those audio commentaries somewhere. There's a website where you can,
I think there is.
Because I've got them, but I just don't remember where I got them.
It may be the Swedish, from Sweden Would Love website. I'm not sure that Anders Frey runs, or I'm not sure about that. Or
you could probably, if somebody out there, if you're wondering what I'm talking about, there's the audio commentaries that go along with the first three, I believe.
I think so, yeah.
And they're really fascinating. And there are a lot of fun stories on there. How true they are, like you said, I don't know. But if you Google it, you could probably find them.
But
you could
that's one of the things we encountered even doing the DVDs that we did, because... you doing our research, I try to go back to the original newspaper stories from the time and so on to see what was going on around the making of these films, and found some things that, you know, we'd never heard of before, like when they were shooting From Russia With Love up in Scotland, you know, doing the helicopter chase stuff. Reading one of the British papers from that time, I found out that Daniela Bianchi had been in a car wreck on the way up there for the shooting.
Oh, wow.
You know, and this is something no one had known about before, and I think we mentioned that in the audio commentary on that DVD. So, you know, we would do the research, and then when we interviewed the people, we'd ask them about, you know, tell us about this story or that. And what we would find is, as with anything, if you get four people together and have them witness an event and ask each of them to tell you about it, you're going to get four different interpretations of what happened.
Sure.
So ultimately, we just had to kind of weave together these various stories into what we thought was possibly the truest version. You know, but I don't think you can ever get 100% accurate truth in any of those things.
Well, so let's see. I want to stick on the James Bond DVD stuff for a little bit and kind of dig around in that. So you're putting those together. Give us a couple examples of things that you found, or because you just kind of mentioned one there. Things that really jump out at you still is like, oh, I'm glad we were able to put that on there. People didn't know about that. What kind of jumps out?
Well, it's things like. As someone who's written a lot of books on film history and so on, I mean, what normally happens with these is somebody will come along who's got a real interest in something and write a book about it, and if there are any inaccuracies in that, the next person who comes along to write the book refers back to the first one thinking it's all true, so they keep repeating all the inaccuracies, right? And then it gets accepted as fact, and it's not always the case.
That's history.
For instance, when we were, you know, it had been sort of accepted legend that Eon Productions, the Eon, meant everything or nothing. Totally not true.
Wow, no way.
Not true at all.
So the movie is not even accurately named right. There's the documentary about it. There's the movie Everything or Nothing.
It is a misnomer, yes.
Whoa. Because breaking news on the White Rocket Show.
And we got this straight from Michael Wilson, who should know.
He
was an attorney before he became a film producer.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is law firms, and especially entertainment law firms, will always have what they call shell companies, right?
Oh.
Which have a name, they're all fully registered, and if a client comes in and says, I've got this particular thing going on now and I need a company to pair with it, so I have an actual company doing it, they pull a company off the shelf that's already kind of set up and they're off and running. And Eon was a shell company, right?
Whoa.
So Eon Productions is not, it doesn't mean everything or nothing, it's just a a company the law firm happened to have that was ready to go.
But it made a good story.
And yeah, so makes a good story, and it keeps getting repeated.
So they went, they retrofitted it. It's a retcon, basically, in the comics.
More or less, yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating. See, okay, so that's a really good one. So what about, like, did you find stuff about, like, the actors, the Bond actors or anything? Or what sort of stuff did you put together on them that kind of stands out to you as, like, oh, that was a really cool thing we were able to kind of bring to the public?
Oh, that's a... Boy, I'd have to think about that one a bit. I mean, there were some things, like, I wasn't aware that the... Stanley Baker, I think, is not Stanley Baker's... I'm sorry, the actor who plays the head of the College of Arms and Majesties.
Oh, gosh, I can't... Oh, no. We all know who you're talking about.
Yes, this is one of those times when I wish we could just, like, pause, go look it up. But anyway, that actor had actually tested for the role of James Bond, and I wasn't aware of that.
Didn't realize that either.
Yeah,
wow.
He had told us that, yeah. So there's... But you have to figure, too, you know, especially at that time when Sean Connery had walked away from it, you know, they were testing any male actor who could breathe and walk upright was talked about for James Bond.
And is that not the actor that ends up overdubbing the voice
of Lazenby for the better part of the movie? Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
They overdubbed a lot of voices in those early Bond movies. Wasn't there, like, one woman that did, like, the voices of all of them?
Nikki Van Der Sil did most of the Bond movies. She actually wrote a book about it. It just came out a couple of years ago. So, and there's an... the guy who did the voice of Blofeld, whose name is escaping me now. This is not... Sorry, folks, it's been a long day. My brain's getting tired here. I think the same guy who did Goldfinger might also have done Mark Andstrako, too. I'm not sure. I'd have to double-check that. But there's a few of those actors who, you know, turn up in multiple movies.
The guy that did Tiger Tanaka was one that had done some other things, I believe. And also the main villain in Thunderball was dubbed by...
Right. Largo, right, was dubbed by someone else. Yeah.
Yeah. So...
I mean, that was a common practice in especially European films, but British films, to do that kind of overdubbing and... even, you know, the Tarzan films in the 60s, the ones that were shot down in Brazil or Mexico, they basically shot them silent and did all the sound effects and the dialogue in the studio when they got back.
Why do you suppose they used that same lady to overdub all, so many different women's voices? Did they just like the way
she
performed?
Because she had a really sexy voice, that's why.
Yeah. And she's better than all the actors.
And you know, if you've seen interviews with Ursula Andress, you understand why they would want to dub her voice. And she's a lovely lady, but... You know, her voice does not match her looks.
They dubbed Bianchi, too, right? In
Daniela Bianchi and...
So Pussy Galore was the first one that didn't have to be overdubbed of the major Bond women, I guess.
Probably so. I'm thinking they also dubbed Domino. Thunderball. Yeah. And definitely the Japanese actresses.
Oh, so. Yeah. So what's her name that played... I'm blanking out, too, but that played Pussy Galore... She would have been like Honor Blackman would have been like the only actor, the only Bond girl, not only the oldest one at that point, but the only one that got to use her own voice. Isn't that interesting? I hadn't thought about that.
I think so. Maybe Karen Dorr in You Only Live Twice also. But
That's so cool. So, okay. While we're talking about Bond, let's do a little basic Bond stuff because we're both real big Bond fans. I haven't asked you this yet. What is your favorite of the 24 Eon Bonds?
I always say my favorite Bond is From Russia with Love, because to me that's just a really, even if you're not a Bond fan, that's just a really good spy thriller, and I think it's very close to the Fleming source material. My second favorite is Honor Majesty's Secret Service, for much the same reasons, and those are two Bond films where he's not really relying on gadgets, although it is a suitcase that saves his day and From Russia with Love. The most entertaining, if someone came up to me and said... you know, I've never seen a Bond film before. What should I watch? I'd say Goldfinger, because that's one that even, you know, I've shown it to my film students who aren't big Bond fans, and they love it because it's one that just from the fade in to the fade out, I think it just fires on all cylinders.
Sure.
It's not a real misstep in that film. So those are the top three in my book, and then after that it starts getting real muddy. But Casino Royale would be way up there too, because I enjoy that one.
Absolutely, I would say it gets better every time I see it. I think you'd be interested to know I run a Facebook group called Secret Agents and Super Spies, and we did it has about 150 members of James Bond spy type fans. We did a World Cup of James Bond movies when after Spectre had been out for a while. We had that gave us 24, so we could do brackets. Mm-hmm. So we did six brackets of four, and they played round robins, ended up all the way down in the final two, because we voted in each round to get the two, okay? The final two were From Russia With Love and On Her Majesty's Secret Service. See? Your two.
There we go.
And On Her Majesty's Secret Service won.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I think it's a great film.
It's the one that the real Bond
aficionados,
they seem to really love, yeah. I think the general public has low regard for it, mainly because of Lazenby.
I think that's it, and I think there was a perception for a long time that the film was a failure, but it actually did respectable business when it was out in theaters. It wasn't a huge hit, but certainly didn't make the kind of money they hoped it would.
Right.
But it made money. It wasn't a bomb by any means.
Sure.
It is one of the first films, I think, because they were concerned about how it would perform, that they did the made like 1,200 prints and released them all on the same day.
Hmm.
So it was like the first of the films that was released the way all movies are released today.
Yeah.
So that's a little interesting tidbit there.
It is, yeah.
But I mean, certainly, but when it came out, there was Lazenby was still the Bond of record. There was still talk of him doing other films. So it was only after that that the relations between him and the producers really soured.
No kidding.
I remember coming across a photo of Lazenby in a pool in L.A. holding Jill St. John around the time of Majesty's release. So.
Wow. Yeah, that just didn't work out. Didn't happen.
Nope. Mm. I don't think she'd been cast in Diamonds at that point. He was just dating her.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Isn't that interesting? Okay, just all these fascinating little tidbits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's how you look at the movies. Who is your favorite Bond actor?
I'm a Sean Connery fan, but I think, if you ask any Bond fan who their favorite is, it's usually going to be the first one they saw playing Bond. So for me, it's Sean Connery.
Well, the problem with that is the first one that I saw was Roger Moore. And he is not my favorite by any means.
Your favorite is?
Oh, my favorite is Pierce Brosnan.
Well, I'm a big Brosnan fan, too.
But, yeah, the listeners are very familiar that I always say my favorite is Pierce Brosnan, but the best is Sean Connery. There's just certain things about Brosnan that I personally find appealing and enjoy, but I will readily admit that the one that carries off the role, the best was the early Connery, yeah.
By the time he stopped playing him, I was getting very turned off by Roger Moore. But going back and rewatching some of those films now, I can really appreciate what he did. Mm. And I feel like, to a large degree, every actor playing Bond reflects the times in which those films were made.
That is true. Right?
So if Sean Connery had continued playing Bond into the 70s the same way he played Bond in the 60s, the character wouldn't have lasted, right?
Okay.
And I think that's why, the Bond in Diamonds Are Forever, it's a much kind of looser, jokier Bond than, say,
Russia
Would Love,
Right, it's not the Sean Connery Bond anymore. He's in a transition. He's almost half Sean Connery, half Roger Moore at that point.
Pretty much. And then even when you get Roger Moore, he's still kind of half and half in those first two Roger Moore films. Yeah. And by the time you get to Timothy Dalton, I mean, that was kind of a time when action movies in general were much more hard-bitten and cynical and hard-edged. So that's Timothy Dalton, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And when Pierce Brosnan comes along, it's kind of almost like a breath of fresh air, but he's got some of the, as you've pointed out, I think, some of the best qualities of all of the Bonds. He's got some of the light humor of Roger Moore, but he can turn on a dime and be as tough and steely as Sean Connery. So
yeah.
And then, when you get into the post 9/11 era, we get Daniel Craig, who I think...
He's just the war machine, basically. He's a robot.
Yeah, very much. But I feel like these later films, particularly Quantum of Solace, I think, were very influenced by the popularity of the Bourne movies, the Jason Bourne films. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, to be fair, in Casino Royale, he does have the moments with
Vesper.
Vesper that are emotional, but it's still like he's really having to fight hard to be, in that mode. It's not natural. It seems like he's neither natural doing emotional stuff or funny stuff. He's in his element when he's a hard charging assassin, basically.
Yeah, he really is the blunt instrument in that film.
He really is. Yeah, he's basically the hammer, and every problem is a nail in his movies.
And I have to say, when he was cast, I think I went out and saw Layer Cake, and I liked him in Layer Cake, but I just couldn't still quite picture him as Bond,
Yeah.
And the my feeling was that they, you know, it's like he reminded me of like a what you would picture a soccer thug in Britain, looking like, you know, and not my conception of Bond. So it was the same with Pierce Brosnan in a way, where I went in not expecting much of him, and by the time the film was over, I thought, wow, this guy really nailed it, you know. And he does have a charisma that you can't deny, you know.
It seems like so many of them, their first movie's good, and it kind of tails off. I mean, that's true of Brosnan, it's probably true of Craig, it's true of Roger Moore to a certain degree. I mean, Roger Moore basically got the reincarnation and have a second run, you know. That's kind of the difference to me. They each got four. Roger Moore got to the... You'd think Roger Moore's natural end would have been Moonraker, but then they re-upped him and you get the 80s movies with him. You know, that could have been another actor starting out. Because For Your Eyes Only seems like the first movie for a new actor in a way.
It does, yeah. It's a real reinvention of the characters. Mm-hmm. I think they felt at that point, having taking Bond to the moon and shooting ray guns and stuff, you know, they had to, you know, bring the character down to earth, as they say.
Let's not speak too much ill of Moonraker. We have a fondness on this show for Moonraker, you know. Mm-hmm. okay, so let's see. What else about Bond do we need to talk about? We're doing this kind of on the fly in just a conversation, and I think that's perfectly fine. But I want to make sure we cover everything. What else have you found or discovered about Bond over the...
Well, one of the things I found interesting, and again, I'm really blessed being able to do those DVDs, because, you know, mm-hmm. here I am, this, you know, kid from lower middle class family in Alabama, ending up working on, you know, these documentaries that are sort of paying tribute to one of my childhood heroes.
Sure, yeah.
And being able to talk to so many of the filmmakers who worked on the Bond films and you know, hear their interviews and so on. One of the things that struck me is, particularly with those early Bonds, those Connery Bonds, so many of the people who worked on those were World War II veterans, right?
Yeah.
And when you hear them tell about their war experiences, mm-hmm. They were very Bond-like. These were real adventurers, you know. These were guys who were doing raids and spy missions and things like that. So, you know, I think a lot of that kind of permeates the early Bond films, or from the top all the way down to the bottom. All the guys working on those films really understood that world and understood that character.
Mm-hmm.
And the farther you get into the series, I think the less that's true. That after a while, you get people who kind of have some conception of what they think Bond is, but they don't really understand it in the way that first team of Bond technicians did.
They knew it maybe from the movies rather than knowing it going into the movies. Yeah, that's interesting. So they're kind of almost just regurgitating an already falsified thing and making it maybe even more, you know, more artificial in a way.
And I mean, you know, the Connery Bonds, they do have a fantastic element to them with the Ken Adams sets and the real high-key cinematography of Ted Moore. But again, these are guys who understood that, you know, that kind of almost comic book quality to them sort of, you know, plays off that hard-bitten spy ethos, you know. And later on, I think you get people who either don't understand that and don't take advantage of it. And you know, Peter Lamont, wonderful guy, God bless him, but he just doesn't have the vision of a Ken Adam, you know.
Well, who does? Yeah, a few do, so.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, and I think the later films suffer for that, you know, that you don't get those guys who have that imagination.
Yeah, that's right. So what do you hope happens next with Bond? Are you hoping Craig comes back, or is there somebody that you see out there that you'd like to take over?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, if it's like I, in my Facebook page every day, I'm seeing all these things that crop up from the various news groups and so on of, you know, there's going to be a female James Bond. There's going to be a black James Bond. Daniel Craig's not coming back, or they've cast this actor, or they've cast that actor. This is the sort of stuff that basically goes on all the time between Bond films.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a constant chatter.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's all totally meaningless, because none of us know what's going on with, you know, the Bond producers and Daniel Craig and so on. For all we know, you know, he's happy to keep playing Bond, you know. You can't believe all the stuff you see in the press.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'd like to see him make another one. I enjoy watching him play James Bond.
You want to see another Craig?
I wouldn't mind it if they get, you know, storylines that appeal to me more than the last two or three have, you know.
Let's talk about that then. I am a firm believer. All right, let me ask you this first. We've already chatted a little bit about Spectre, and I know that you are not a fan of Spectre. Okay.
No, didn't care it's that much respect or no. And Skyfall, I didn't like nearly as much as everyone else.
No, me either. Yeah. Okay, I like Spectre better than Skyfall, in fact. So.
Yeah, they're about even for me.
Okay. Mendez, to me, I guess the actors like him. I guess he can do stunts or whatever, but I don't like what he does with, I don't know, the story. There's something about how he carries off those two movies. They seem too self-referential, too historically referential. It's like every scene in both. Let me put it this way. With Skyfall, I could put up with it. Because Skyfall was the 50th anniversary movie. And I thought, okay, he's going to put some references in some scenes, you know, the Aston Martin and whatnot. You know, he was going to have Sean Connery be
right.
the guy at the end. I'm like, that's fine. It's the 50th anniversary movie. It makes $1 billion. I can put up with that. Spectre was even worse about that. It's like every scene in Spectre was not so much about advancing Spectre as saying, hey, look, I watched Live and Let Die. You know, well, I saw that movie. Here's a scene with, you know.
Well, again, the biggest beef I have with Spectre is I felt like they ripped the plot off from Austin Powers and Goldmember.
God, that's a sad indictment there.
You can't have the hero and the villain be that intimately connected. And it's, you know, it's kind of a modern thing with films is this idea that, I wish filmmakers could get it through their head that if you're doing a movie about a hero, it's okay to just let them be heroic. You don't have to explain it. It doesn't have to be because of something that happened in their childhood. It's not some reaction to a deep psychotic hurt, you know. It's just like, let them be a hero.
You know? Well, you know, that's interesting you say that, because that was one of the innovations of the Craig era, is that they actually have gone back and looked a little bit at his childhood and his origins and everything. They never did that in the movies before Craig, did they?
No.
He was James Bond, and that's all you needed to know.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. I mean, in the novels, I believe he was British up until the time that Dr. No from Russia with Love were made, and Fleming, upon seeing those and seeing Connery playing Bond, thought, okay, I'm going to make him Scottish.
Or one of his parents was Scottish, right?
Right, so you get that in the novel of Honor Majesty's mm-hmm. Secret Service, you know, which, again, the novel has a film reference in it, because there's a part in there where Bond's in a cafe, I think, up at Peace Gloria or somewhere, and sees the film actress Ursula Andress.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's really only been with the Craig era that they've tried to actually establish him as having a backstory, having a family, having a history. And that's where they tied Blofeld in, and it just didn't work for me because, you know, I gave a decent review to Spectre at the time it came out, but I said at the time that the final act didn't work for me, and the whole thing didn't work for you, right? I mean,
you know, once it became clear that they were making that kind of connection of them being the mm-hmm. you know, boyhood friends who became enemies, I just kind of tuned out at that point.
So do you want Mendez to come back then, or do you blame him or credit him, or what do you think? Because I mean, I feel I kind of blame him for these two being not so great.
I will say this much. Of the recent Bond films, the ones I've liked the best were the ones that were directed by Martin
Campbell.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I thought GoldenEye was fantastic. I thought Casino Royale was fantastic.
Absolutely.
I think Martin Campbell has a good understanding of the character. He also did a series in the 80s that I loved called Riley, Ace of Spies. You know, uh-huh. So I think he kind of knows that whole spy world very well.
Nice.
The Quantum of Solace, forget the director's name of that, the German director, I thought was just horribly directed beginning to end. I mean, if you're going to do a chase scene with two cars, don't shoot it all in close-up, and don't make the cars the same color.
No.
If you're going to have two guys kind of swinging off
that's a fair point.
If you're going to have two guys swinging off ropes in an art museum sort of thing, shooting at each other, don't have them wearing the same color suits. You know, I mean, these are basic filmmaking things. You know, you want people to be able to distinguish what's what.
Yeah.
And after seeing Quantum of Solace, it made me really long for The Spy Who Loved Me, where you get the big submarine battles at the end. They give you the wide shot so you know what the geography is. You've got the good guys in the blue suits and you've got the bad guys in the red suits, and it's really easy to keep track of it.
There you go.
So, you know, there's some reasons why they did things like that in those old films, and I think they need to pay attention to that and not try to make it also hyper-realistic that it's hard to understand. You know?
I do love that car chase at the beginning of Quantum of Solace, but you're absolutely right. It could have been even better if they had done just a few basic things that would have helped the audience.
Yeah, because I've watched it several times now, and there's still whole little sections of that where I'm like, now, whose car is that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that Bond? Is that the bad guy? I can't tell.
Yeah. Fair. So,
actually, one of the best fight scenes, I think, in all the Bond films, one of the ones I really loved, is the rooftop fight scene in You Only Live Twice with the helicopter shot that pulls out.
Oh, when he's running?
Where he's running. And
oh, and you get this, wah, 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 wah. I love that.
And it's all one shot, and it's a great little fight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That is a good bit. Okay, so you're okay with Craig coming back for one more.
I'm okay with Craig coming back. You know, there was the big controversy last year about Idris Elba being Bond, you know. Mm-hmm. I'd be fine with that, you know. I mean, you know, a lot of folks are like, ooh, you know, he's, well, the author's saying he's too street getting his foot in his mouth
because
people thinking he's racist and what have you, but I don't think he meant that at all. But, you know, I think the primary qualification for anyone playing James Bond is they have to have charisma.
Yeah.
And Idris Elba's got charisma out the wazoo.
That was the problem Timothy Dalton had.
Had some charisma. He just, his Bond was utterly lacking in charm, which is another thing Bond should able to pour on the charm. And,
yeah, that's why I think why I like Pierce Brosnan so much is that he was very charming, very appealing, but he could also be rough and tough.
Yeah, and he was charismatic and you know, handsome as all get out. You know?
Absolutely. So I'm on record wanting Aidan Turner.
Yeah, I don't know if I've actually seen anything he's in.
Or The Hobbit?
I didn't see The Hobbit.
What's the Masterpiece Theater? Poldark.
Poldark, yeah. I knew they'd remade that. I haven't actually seen it. But
it's really good.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's all kinds of actors out there who could do it and who could do it really well. You know, but like I say, it's just a matter of, you know. At this point, I think they're Eon and MGM are looking for a partner, I think. Maybe their deal with Columbia is up or something. I can't remember. Yeah. So, you know, hopefully there will be another Bond film, and I'm sure when there is, good or bad, I'm sure I'll be there to see it.
Well, you got
to
think there's one coming along at some point. I hope we don't have another multi-year layoff like we had between Quantum of Solace and Skyfall, right? That was 4 years.
Or between License to Kill and GoldenEye.
Yeah, even worse, yeah, absolutely. But other stuff that you've done, I want to touch on some of that as well. Tell us about your affinity for Superman and a little bit about the book you did about Superman.
Well, again, when I was a very young kid, before I watched James Bond movies on TV, when I was very little, I used to see reruns of The Adventures of Superman with George Reeves. It's one of the earliest things I remember seeing on TV, that and The Lone Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, when I first moved out to Los Angeles, there was a ski convention at the convention center, Ski Dazzle 80, in October 1980, and the Grand Marshal was Clayton Moore, The Lone Ranger. So I went down and met Clayton Moore and got my picture taken with him. And I have to say, to this day, I haven't met anyone I was more excited about meeting than The Lone Ranger.
Wow.
Those are two shows I loved when I was a kid. And after doing the James Bond book, I wanted to do another book that would kind of take me back to my childhood. So I thought Superman was a pretty obvious choice. So I wrote the Superman book. And then, like I say, going around with conventions to that, people are like, when are you going to do a Batman book? So I did a Batman book.
Well, what kind of things do you include in your Superman book?
Well, it starts with the history of the creation of the character by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, and then goes into not so much the history of him in the comics. I touch on that a little bit in that chapter, and the sort of tragedy of those two and how, you know, for $10 a page, they sold their 13-page Superman story to National Comics and sold their copyright along with it for $130. You know? After that chapter, there's one on Superman on radio, Superman on Broadway, the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons, the serials, the TV show, all the other sort of TV iterations and movies. And
there's so many, too. Yeah, I mean, is there any character that's been portrayed in different media more, probably? I mean, it seemed like there might be, but It's got to be up there.
If I remember right, the characters that has been portrayed the most in movies overall is like Jesus Christ, Dracula, and Sherlock Holmes.
Right,
and maybe Abe Lincoln after that, you know, more than anyone else. But you forget how many people have played Superman until you start researching something like this. And you had the old Superboy TV series in the 90s, and then Lois and Clark and Smallville, and
It seems like very few years go by that there's not some Superman related thing on TV, and that's not true about many other properties.
Well, I think The Adventures of Superman went off the air 1958-59. It was in syndication for another 15 or 20 years after that. You didn't really get another Superman-related television show until the Superboy series in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm. But after that, it's just almost been continuous.
It's been fairly continuous since then.
It's amazing. I can't think of any other property that just keep bringing... Even Sherlock Holmes. I mean, we've got a couple of Sherlock Holmes things semi going on currently, but before that, it was a while before, since the last, I mean, maybe Jeremy Brett's show back in the 80s was the last one before Sherlock.
Well, there are shows that were done in the UK, of course, it didn't get shown here. Like, there's a series in the 60s of Sherlock Holmes. Forget the actor, Douglas Wilmer, originally, and then after that, Peter Cushing took it over.
Mm-hmm.
So that ran for about 3 or 4 years, I want to say, in the 60s, but didn't make it across the pond here. You can get them now on DVD. But,
right.
And then in the 50s, there was the one with Ronald Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Sherlock Holmes has been on TV probably every generation. There were some TV movies in the 70s. Roger Moore played Sherlock Holmes in Sherlock Holmes in New York.
I didn't realize
With Patrick McNee as his Watson.
Oh, wow.
John Huston is Moriarty. It's a great little
film. He ends up being his sidekick in A View to a Kill.
Yep.
A movie I didn't expect to be talking about tonight. I had to say, A View to a Kill has always been my least favorite Bond. I don't want to go back to Bond, but I had to say.
It is my absolute least favorite.
It's the bottom of the barrel.
At this point, Quantum of Solace gives it a good run for its
money. No. Quantum of Solace has got a couple of really good bits, though, among all the dung. But A View to a Kill
has some good individual stunts, talk about lost opportunities in that film. I mean, and I think that's the one where even Roger Moore realized afterwards that he really needed it.
It's time. It was time, Roger.
Yeah.
Okay, so your Superman book. So you sort of go through and you're documenting the history of these different shows and.
Yeah, it's kind of. Sort of the history of the character in popular culture and how in different eras, he sort of represents different things or is portrayed in a different way. If you look at the Adventures of Superman show with George Reeves, he was sort of the super parent, and it's almost like Lois and Jimmy are the kids that he has to kind of keep in line, And then you get to Smallville, and especially the first couple of seasons where it's Clark getting these weird powers that come up, and he doesn't know why or how to deal with them. I mean, it's a kid going through puberty. So
it's more like the X-Men in a way, like a little bit. Becoming a mutant kind of or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you tried not being Superman, Superboy, or whatever? I never really watched Smallville, so I don't know what the quality of that show was. Well, that was people seem to like it though.
I must admit, I didn't really start watching it until I started working on the book, and got all the. It was still on the air at that point, but I went back and got all the previous episodes and watched them. And really, it seemed to take about half a season or the first season to really figure out where it was going, because they were falling into a pattern of sort of geek of the week, they called it, and someone else affected by the meteor rocks, had some weird power that he'd have to combat.
Well, that was the show. I believe there were two episodes I have watched. If that's the show I'm thinking of, is that the show that had the Legion of Superheroes one episode and had the Justice Society or something one episode?
Yes, they did. Yeah.
Okay, I watched those two, and I had no interest in what Superboy was doing or anything like that. I was just watching the Legion of Superheroes and Hawkman and Dr. Fate or whatever. So, yeah. Okay, so people started saying, "Well, you did a Superman book. Where's the Batman book?" Right? It's like salt and pepper. You got to have the pepper.
So I did a Batman book.
So you did a Batman book.
And actually, the first interview I did for the Batman book was with Michael G. Wilson, the producer of the James Bond films.
How did that work out?
it worked out fine. I just contacted his secretary and said, I'm working on this and I'd like to interview you for it. And they gave me a time. I called him up and, we had like 45 minutes on the phone or something like that. But, it's a little known fact, or at least it was then. Michael G. Wilson's dad is Lewis Wilson, who was the very first actor to play Batman in the serials. And later on, I contacted Michael Uslan, who has produced all the Batman films from the Michael Keaton Batman forward. And when I got him on the phone, he's like, well, you know, I don't have much time. Go ahead and start asking your questions. He said, who has to be interviewed? And I said, well, I interviewed Michael Wilson, because, his dad was the first Batman. He goes, really? I did not know that. Okay, what do you want to know? So after that, he spoke to me for like 90 minutes.
Your bona fides were set. Yeah. You were good to go.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So was that why you were talking to Michael Wilson? Was because of his dad? It was not a producing thing or a studio thing that I don't know about?
No, at that point I was calling him strictly to talk about his dad and what he remembered about his dad and playing Batman and did he hear any stories and so on. And that makes, the interview I did with him makes up a great part of that chapter in his memories of his dad and so on. And then I got in touch with another lady who had, her dad had been really good friends with Douglas Croft, who played Robin in that serial.
Oh,
so
okay.
She had some stories about him. So that's one of the things that, John Cork and I tried to do with James Bond, The Legacy, and I've tried to do it every book I've done since then, is just dig as deep as possible into the research and try to go back and do as many primary interviews as possible. Because I'd like to think that even if you're the most hardcore fan of these characters ever, you could pick up those books and find one or two or three things that you just didn't know. Yeah. So
that is amazing. So, I just imagine that when you called up to get an interview with him, he's thinking, oh, he wants to talk about the James Bond movies, or he wants to find out who
I'd already prepped
him.
I mean, again, I'd contacted the secretary first, said, I want to speak to Michael Wilson about, I'm writing a book about Batman, I want to talk to him about his father, Lewis Wilson.
So he was much more willing, probably, than just the average guy wanting to talk about James Bond.
Oh, I expect so.
That's pretty cool.
And, I'd met him a couple of times by that point, too, having worked on the DVD, so it wasn't like I was a total stranger that, never...
So your last question to him wasn't like, so when you think about your father, Mr. Wilson, who would your father have wanted to be the next James Bond? Go.
Right. Was not asking that,
Go.
Was not saying, so when are you reading scripts for the writers who's going to be doing the next Bond?
Because I've got a script here. I can crank one out for you.
Funny story there, actually. Yeah. When I was in college at USC, 1980-81, at that point, I love James Bond movies. I'm going to film school, and I thought, I'm going to write a screenplay, and I love James Bond. I wrote a James Bond script.
Oh, awesome.
It involved Bond and Anya Amasova in going up against Blofeld and some settings in the Arctic, and I can't remember the entire plot now, but I titled that script Spectre.
So you could have sued him on that.
Yeah,
really, Wow. I have no doubt it was a better script than certainly the last third of the actual one.
I haven't reread that script since I wrote it, 30-some-odd years ago. I'd hate to think what's in that script now. It'd just be embarrassing.
Now I've got to read it. Now you got to get me a copy, because now I really want to compare it to the movie and see if it would have been better.
It's deep in storage somewhere.
That's awesome. So, okay, so you do the Batman book, and... did you find out anything about Batman that the world did not really know or that you were really surprised by? Or was it all pretty much about what you think?
Well, it's interesting looking at the origin of Batman. This is one of the things I wrote about was how Bob Kane had basically shafted Bill Finger, who co-created Batman and never got any of the credit until recently.
Right.
And I'd like to think my book had a little bit to do with that, but there's also a writer who... did a book about Bill Finger recently, and he'd also done one on Siegel and Schuster, and I can't remember his name now, Mark something. I apologize that I can't remember his name. But he was the one who I think was the first to sort of break the Bill Finger story and kind of bring it to light and so on. And then Michael Uslan too, it said that one of his joys was that the Dark Knight premiere, I think they had Athena Finger, who is Bill Finger's daughter, there.
Oh, wow.
And he said he was, happy to be able to walk her down the red carpet and introduce her to people as the daughter of the creator of Batman, co-creator. So Michael Uslan is someone who's kind of championed that as well, you know.
I like his relative in Game of Thrones, Little. Littlefinger, sorry. My audience got it. Okay, so then you do a Dracula book. That seems a little off the path from the three rock and roll heroes you've done up to this point. How did that come about?
One of the first things I remember seeing on TV when I was a kid was Shock Theater. My brother and I would stay up on Saturday nights and watch Shock Theater.
This is not like Count Floyd, is it?
No.
Ooh, boys and girls, scary. Ooh.
It was that sort of thing. But basically, Universal in the late 50s, early 60s packaged all their old horror movies together in a package called Shock Theater that they sold to TV stations around the country. And some of these stations had the local horror host, but in Huntsville, Alabama, they didn't. They just ran the movies.
Hey, in Alabama, we're doing good to have the TV, much less a host. Come on.
And I'm watching these on a little black and white TV with my brother, and still, Bela Lugosi scared the bejesus out of me. Okay. You know? And then Frankenstein even more so, but I loved it. And, you know, we've loved those old scary movies ever since then. And way back in the late 80s, I was thinking about doing a book on Dracula and had done a little bit of research, but never followed through with it. And was just beginning to do research on a book about Tarzan in the movies when my book agent contacted me and said, hey, there's this company, they do this series of books called the FAQ series. Oh. You know, they've done Sherlock Holmes FAQ, Star Trek, Doctor Who, et cetera, et cetera. Said, I think you'd be a good fit for them. So I jotted down about a dozen ideas of things I'd like to write about and send it off to them, and they came back and said that they'd like to do the Dracula book. So for the next year or so, I was just doing nothing but eat, sleep, and breathing Dracula, because it was normally with the like Batman book, the Superman book, I'd take a year or year and a half to do the research, and then another almost a year to write it. And then this one, I had just a little more than a year from the time they said go, actually a little less than a year from the time they said go till the time I had to go off to the publisher to write it and, you know, do all the research and do the writing and pull the photos and all that. So, I enjoyed doing it. And again, since I'd been wanting to do it for all those years, it, you know, I had all that.
Just fell right in your lap. And you
pretty much, yeah.
So when Michael Whelan did the cover paintings for the H.P. Lovecraft stuff, he said that I'm taking this to what you're talking about. We're talking about Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
He said that it was a bright, sunny week in his neighborhood, and he just couldn't paint H.P. Lovecraft because it was too nice outside. So he put black sheets over all of his windows and played funeral music, you know, and then he could paint. So I'm wondering, when you're writing about Dracula, if it was in a nice, bright, sunny time and you're just having to talk about the evil vampire when it's... Did you have to do anything, play any kind of music, get you in the right mood?
I rewatched a lot of the vampire movies and Dracula films. I mean, rewatched all the old Universal movies, the Hammer films and so on. I'll tell you a Christopher Lee story in a minute. At that time, I was getting my, I'd gone back to school at 50 to get my MA and in England. And in my last trip over there, when I graduated, I went over for the graduation. And after graduation, the next day, I got on the train, went up to Yorkshire and spent about 4 days in Whitby, which is a lovely little seaside town. But the thing Whitby is most famous for is it's one of the locations in Stoker's Dracula.
Oh.
You know, I mean, there's... that's where Dracula's ship runs aground in England, and the wolf leaps out, and you know, then he terrorizes Lucy and Mina and so on. So to be there where, you know, Stoker, the reason that's in the novel is Stoker had gone there to vacation at one point when he was thinking about writing this vampire story and sort of fell in love with Whitby and started writing Dracula there and went into the library there and saw a book on Transylvanian history and came across the name Dracula. Because he was going to call him Count Vampire, which would have been a little on the nose,
little
you think?
On the nose, right, yeah.
But he sees about Dracula, this, you know, Transylvania
Prince. A little on the nose for a two.
Yes, there we go.
Sorry, I'm sorry. People just tuned out all across America and the world.
That's so bad. Anyway.
Sorry.
But yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, I would go to the little, you know, cafes and shops and things there. There was a... one tea shop in particular, the Mad Hatter's Tea Room, had a kind of Lewis Carroll theme to it.
Oh, very nice.
But you could sit there and have the British tea, and I had my laptop and look out the window and see the ruins of the abbey across the way.
Oh, wow.
And the abbey ruins is kind of what inspired Castle Dracula, you know.
Nice.
So yeah, that was a wonderful place to go and start work on the book, you know. And
there you go.
And then much of it after that was just, you know, as boring as it sounds, me piled up on the couch with my laptop, which is how I do most of my writing.
Sure.
Mark Twain used to write in bed. I write, you know, behind on the couch. The Christopher Lee story, working on all the James Bond stuff. At one point, when we were starting to do the final set of six Bond DVDs, we knew that Patrick McNee, who'd been doing our narration since he was in View to a Kill, couldn't very well narrate the View to a Kill documentary and be interviewed in it, right?
Yeah.
So we thought, well, we've got to get someone else, and I recommended Christopher Lee, who happened to be in L.A. at that time. So we arranged a lunch with him, and we're having lunch, and tell him about this. And he's like, well, I'm about to go off to Australia. They're doing a film of The Lord of the Rings. It's my favorite book. I read it every year, and I'm going to be playing Saruman. And they're going to use special effects to make me this tall, and Elijah Wood's in it, and they'll use special effects to make him this high, and you know, all this sort of. So he wasn't available. Awesome. But I had read his autobiography, which it's an interesting autobiography because I swear three-quarters of it is just golfing stories because he loved golf, right? Interspersed with little bits. And, you know, he talks about Dracula for like a page, you know. But he mentioned in there that he and Peter Cushing, you know, very dear friends, would call each other every day, especially near the end of Peter's life. And whenever they would talk to each other on the phone, they would talk in the voices of Warner Brothers cartoon characters.
They would. Why not?
So we're at this lunch because they love the Warner Brothers cartoons. So we're having this lunch, and I said to Christopher Lee, I said, you know, you've got such a deep, rich, sonorous voice. I can't imagine you doing a Warner Brothers cartoon character.
Oh, no.
And he says, great suffering succotash. So.
Oh, no. That is such a bizarre story. It has to be true. Wow.
Well, he was another one. You know, like Patrick McNee, they were two actors. You just ask them about their career, and they could go on for hours. They were, great raconteurs, and just, you know, I could listen. Both of them with those very distinctive voices, you know, I could sit there and listen all day. And Christopher Lee, too, very tall. I'm 5'7". I think he was like 6'7". So, you know, I came up to below his shoulder. You know? So, but, yeah, he was... I feel very fortunate I had the opportunity to meet him, because when I was a kid, you know, I loved those Hammer horror films that he was in. So. And, of course, Man with the Golden Gun.
He is the Man with the Golden Gun, absolutely. He's always, to me, going to be an actor that was so great, but never got to play, at least for me, the one role that would be just the absolute iconic. In other words...
Well, Dracula.
Well, I know, but that's not... This is, to me...
After that lunch, I contacted a friend of mine who's a big film buff, and I said, you know, I just came back from lunch. I had lunch with Frankenstein's Monster, Dracula, Sherlock Holmes, and Mycroft Holmes. He goes, oh, you had lunch with Christopher Lee. Because no other actors played all those roles. Right. You know? The Mummy, you know.
I think of him as the leader of the aliens on Space 1999 that took Commissioner Simmons back to Earth in the glass box. But that's just me. And then, of course, Scaramanga.
But Peter Cushing's another one who, you know, you watch those old Frankenstein movies and Hammer films, and I mean, he's a marvelous actor, mm-hmm. you know, and his Sherlock Holmes, he's great in those, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's not, people don't think of him as being like an Olivier or James Mason or like A-list actor, but he was every bit as talented as those guys were.
Absolutely.
You know, those movies are the better because they had such good actors.
Oh, yeah. Right. They way outkicked their coverage, as we say. They had actors that, these were... I mean, they weren't low-budget movies, right? They were kind of...
The Hammer films are pretty low-budget.
Pretty low, yeah. But yet they had these actors that today you'd be like, how did they ever get those people, you know?
Yeah, well, if they were still working today, they'd probably be making a lot more money than they did then. Yeah,
right. But, so, all right. Let's see. Last thing or two. We've talked about your four books and working on the DVDs. What else have we not talked about that you've done or been involved in terms of this entertainment stuff that we probably need to know about?
Well, anyone who's worked in the entertainment industry knows if you want to go into a kind of stable field, you don't go into the arts, you don't go into entertainment.
Right.
Because I always say, if I really made a list of every job I've had since I got out of college to now, it would be as thick as a phone book, you know. Because I've done, you know, I worked for some film companies in L.A., I worked in business affairs, I've worked, on some films. I was on the special effects crew of Witchboard and The Kindred and Armed Response, you know, these kind of low-budget horror and action films.
Mm-hmm.
Weirdest job I ever had was decorating Bruce Springsteen's Christmas tree. Which, you know, I knew a guy who did topiaries for some of the stores in Beverly Hills, and one Christmas his client was Bruce Springsteen, and he needed some help and asked if I wanted to do it. I said, absolutely. So I spent about 3 days in Bruce Springsteen's house in Beverly Hills decorating his two-story high Christmas tree.
I don't like to decorate my own Christmas tree. I can't imagine decorating Bruce Springsteen because, I'd be afraid I'd mess something up and I'd get sued for a million
dollars. Well, the things that were readily apparent was Patty runs the show. You know, and Springsteen is, you know, you hardly know he was there. He's very shy, very quiet. You know, it's like a lot of entertainers. They turn it on when they're on stage or on camera, and then after that, you know, he's very almost mousy, you know. And what's the other thing I was going to say that's kind of, Prince. You know, I worked on the Prince Bat Dance video.
No way!
Because the guy that I was doing special effects with at that time, he was hired to do the dry ice fog on the Prince Bat Dance video. So that was over a Memorial Day weekend in 1989, I think. So me and some of my friends there crushing up dry ice and putting it in these big hoppers of hot water and creating the fog. And Prince was someone that going into that, I thought he's going to be this real diva. You know, again, very much like Bruce Springsteen, very quiet, very professional, you know, hardly noise there.
That's something. That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, I've got to ask you one last question for my dear friend, Jim Beard. Jim is the...
Oh, Jim, yeah.
You know Jim. So we have a mutual acquaintance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jim wrote Gotham City 14 Miles or Coordinated.
I met him at a Detroit Comic Con where Yvonne Craig was there, and I'd already spoke to her, so I took him over and introduced him to her. And
bet he lost his mind.
He enjoyed that, yeah. So, Jim's a good guy.
So, what did you find out about that Batman show that Jim loves so much? More than I can possibly fathom why you would, but people don't understand why I like Space 1999.
You had to have been 5 years old in 1966, as I was.
I was negative two, so I didn't. Yeah. I don't get it.
Batman was the bomb, man. It was Bond, Batman, and the Beatles. Those are the three Bs in the mid 60s. You know, it was just a thing, and you know. What did I find out about that show? I mean,
you dig up any interesting stuff about it when you're
putting... I did, actually. There was, I think it was either the first show or the second show they did was preempted by some trouble with one of the Apollo spacecraft, a news report on that.
Oh, like Apollo 13 or something?
It was before Apollo 13. But
oh, right, right. It would have been, yeah.
Well, it was even before Apollo 11. It would have been very early in the
program. Right, you're right, right.
Anyway, whatever it was, there was some problem, and there was a news report where they broke in and, you know, preempted about 20 minutes of Batman. Mm-hmm. And that made ABC Switchboard light up like a Christmas tree because, you know, all the kids who couldn't see Batman, you know, they were losing their minds and their parents were complaining and, you know. So that's, you know, one of those things I think, you know, people either didn't know about or had forgotten about. And that's how I opened that chapter, is talking about that incident.
That's awesome.
What would make people have that kind of reaction? Well, it's because they miss Batman, you know?
Hey, I still blame Jimmy Carter for making me miss part of Battlestar Galactica's premiere.
There we go.
He had to go and have peace in the Middle East. We don't need peace in the Middle East. We need peace with the Cylons by killing them, for crying out, blowing them up.
Oh, and I think it was... Ford pardoning Nixon, I think, kind of preempted Jack Palance Dracula's original showing.
Oh, wow. Right? Wow.
So they had to reschedule that, you know?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's wrap it up. I want you to let people know, if they want to learn more about your books and about you and all that sort of thing, where should they go?
I do have a website, brucecivilly.com. I must admit, I update it about once a year, and I'm sure it's horribly out of date right now. But that's, you know, brucescivally.com.
Okay. I'll try to put a link on the Podbean page.
Cool. I'm also, you can find me on Facebook where, you know, when I come to shows like this, I usually take some photos and start posting on Facebook. There's not very much Wi-Fi available in Metropolis, so
that's
I'm a little behind right now. And all my books are available on Amazon. There's, you know, Kindle versions available of most of them. So, you know, they're not that hard to find.
And I want to point out, they're all wonderful-looking books, because he's got them here at the show, and I've looked at them or through them. But that James Bond book, that is a coffee table size, hardcover.
And it's a very heavy book. John Cork and I used to joke that, you know, it's a coffee table book because if you put four legs on it, you got a coffee table.
That was a bit on Seinfeld, actually. It's a coffee table book about coffee tables that turns into a coffee table.
There we go.
That's it. And, yeah, it's a big, solid, heavy thing.
Yeah, that book, the way we came to do that is it was just after we'd finished doing those first round of DVDs, you know, in 2000 we finished those. And as they were coming up on the 40th anniversary of Bond and Die Another Day coming out, they knew they wanted to do a 40th anniversary book, official book. And I think it just occurred to Barbara Broccoli and the folks there at Eon that, you know, hey, these guys have already interviewed practically everyone who ever worked on the movies. Dude, so they came to us and asked if we wanted to do it. We said, absolutely.
Why not? You put in all the work. You might as well put one more thing.
And the book was designed by the same designers who did the Beatles anthology, which is why it's such a good-looking book.
Well, I'm going to say, it's got giant two-page spread photos of Sean Connery and all that stuff. And I'm just... Yeah, Bruce was nice enough to let me look at it. It took me about 15 seconds. Like, all right, I got to have this. I opened it up to about page 2, page 3, page 4. All right, I got to have this. So I've only looked at about 3 pages of it, and then I immediately bought it from him. So I recommend that you check out all of them, but that's a really gorgeous James Bond book.
I wish all the other books could have been that well put together, you know, but the more photos you have in a book, the more you're paying for licensing. And
that's the truth. That's true. All right. Well, Bruce, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It's been awesome today to get to meet you, hang out with you, talk to you, and then have you come on the show. I really appreciate it.
How can I say no to a fellow Alabamian?
That's it.
Can't
exactly.
do it. It's all been right. good visiting with you.
Yoo-hoo! Y'all check it out. See y'all later. Yeah. All right. All right, I want to thank Bruce once again for coming on the show. If you want to know more about his books, go to Amazon.com or to your local bookstore and ask or look up Bruce Scivalley. That's Scivalley. And I hope you'll check out his books. They are big, substantive tomes. These are not tiny little throwaway books, and in fact the James Bond book is a hardcover coffee table book, and it's spectacular, wonderful photos and more. So check those out, and the Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week, and I will see you guys down the road with episode 100 coming up very soon. Bye bye.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.